I want to get our discussion started here with our distinguished panelists by just getting a brief introduction to what they do and how their work illustrates the intersection we're talking about this morning between the criminal justice system and the mental health system. So I'll begin to my left here with Commissioner Tom Roy. Commissioner Roy.
Good morning, folks. It's a pleasure to be here to see citizens engaged in a discussion around criminal justice. Usually rooms gather full of people around other criminal justice issues when things are going terribly wrong or when a sex offender is moving into the neighborhood. Unfortunately, many folks gather. This is far more positive, and we're very pleased to engage in this discussion. The intersection of mental health and corrections is significant. Over 90% of our people in custody have an association with chemical dependency or chemical abuse. Many of their crimes are committed while they are in that altered state. Many of their failures are the result of their addictions or their abusive behaviors. Certainly, addiction is a mental illness. Beyond addiction, we have other people that have presented significant mental health illness, and that illness is persistent in about 10% of our population. So about 1,000 of folks that are incarcerated have a significant mental illness, and any number of those continue on the street when they're under supervision. So we are very cognizant of the impact of mental illness, and especially as it relates to the criminal conduct. We devote lots of resources internally to behavioral health. It's part of our mandate to provide medical treatment, the constitutional right. And it's part of every day of the way we do our work.
Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI. How does your work intersect? Obviously, mental health, we know, but how does it intersect with the criminal justice system? How often would you say?
Unfortunately, quite a bit. And I really want to thank the students, because what we often don't think about is that half of all mental illnesses begin emerging before the age of 14, 75% by the age of 24. So if we think about the criminal justice system as just adults, we're missing this whole area where we could be intervening. And we know that looking at the juvenile justice system, 70% of those kids have one or more mental health diagnosis. I think one of the other things that certainly came out in their video is that it's hard to get help. We don't like to say that we have a broken mental health system. We like to say that because of the discriminatory public policies, we never built it. And in order to prevent people from getting into the criminal justice system, we need to make sure that people can have easy access to mental health treatment. Public attitudes do play a huge role. We know that people live with their symptoms an average of 10 years before seeking help. Even a young person experiencing their first psychotic episode, so they're hearing things, they're seeing things that are not there, they wait an average of 74 weeks. And so we know what's going to happen. Their symptoms, which are going to be viewed as behaviors, are going to be picked up, or someone's going to call 911 and ask for help. And so then we actually end up having a criminal justice response instead of a healthcare response. And so there are many things that we can do along the way, but certainly in our work, we try to change public attitudes and get people talking about mental illness, and then, of course, work for the policy so that people can have easy access to mental health care like they would for any other illness.
Dr. Eduardo Colon from HCMC, how often does your work there at HCMC intersect with the criminal justice system?
We intersect with the criminal justice system every day. I have the privilege of being the chief of the Department of Psychiatry at Hennepin County Medical Center. We serve a large population of patients with mental illness. As Sue has mentioned, I think one of the things that has happened in our community has been that we no longer rely on long-term court institutionalization, and as people have moved to the community where they belong, we have failed to provide all the supportive services that they need, which are comprehensive, expensive, and require a lot of effort and commitment from the community. When that doesn't happen, then people with mental illness who are struggling with symptomatic behaviors end up at our doorstep, or we end up having to provide services. We serve people in a number of fashions. The first way in which we interface with the law and with our patients is when patients are brought to us by officers, because either they've been disruptive in the community or a family member has been concerned about their behavior. We also have emergency services, our crisis services, that might go to a home and find somebody who needs to be transported to the hospital for help. So people will get brought in primarily because they need mental health interventions. They need help, and that's been recognized. Once people engage in behaviors that have broken the law, then they end up in the correctional system. We provide ongoing services to the jail. We have 24-hour, 7-day-a-week screening now, and I believe it's a very important part of what we need to continue to do, which is to screen people when they enter the correctional system to identify their needs and try and provide the services that they need. When somebody ends up in the hospital, either with a medical problem or with psychiatric behavioral problems, then we provide consultation to the medical surgical services. Our patients get admitted to our units, where we then try and stabilize them while people are being processed, as the system would say, and go through the whole criminal justice system. And lastly, we provide outpatient follow-up, and many people have been released from the correctional system, need ongoing mental health care, and that's a huge challenge, to either be able to establish the connections or to maintain the connections, or people who have special status because of the nature of the crimes they have committed and need to be reintegrated to the society and get their symptoms treated in a way that will allow them to function and not be stigmatized.
Dr. Colon, I want to follow up with you on how is the distinction made between mental illness when it should be, for lack of a better term, civil treatment versus a criminal justice approach? I'm sure that you deal with this all the time, right? Someone's brought in by police. When is the distinction made between this person needs to be in the criminal justice system versus this person needs mental health treatment?
Yeah, that's solely always a very difficult distinction to make at times. I'd like to just make a point to clarify that there are people with mental illness who have committed crimes where the mental illness is not responsible for the crimes they've committed, and that presents a very different circumstance. We have a lot of people who commit crimes who don't have a mental illness, and by the same token, that's a distinction that's hard to make. Frequently, at the time of entry, if you have a system that does a decent job of identifying people with significant mental health problems and psychiatric illness, then there's involvement of the court system in a way, and we call it the Rule 20 assessments, which are assessments to clarify whether somebody's able to stand trial and to defend themselves. And oftentimes we see people cannot participate in the process because they're so mentally ill, have such a severe mental illness. So those people are then adjudicated or sent to the mental health system to receive help. And that is a very complicated process from my standpoint that really requires a lot more efforts in terms of closing that gap and making sure that we can provide the services. So people get identified. If they don't get identified, then essentially they end up going through the process and not receiving the help that they need until the end. And a lot of times the nature of the crime is such that people have to stay within the system, and then the question is, how do we provide humane care, and how do we provide for their needs in a way that not only allows them to function from day to day, but tries to reduce the risk of what happens after they leave and recidivism? And I'm sure Sue has a couple of comments about that process, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what would you say about that?
Definitely. I agree with everything that Eduardo said. I think one of the issues that we see, especially with family members, is that they can't get help, that they have tried. They have, you know, they have called everyone. They have reached out. We had a woman last summer that called whose young relative was developing schizophrenia, and the next appointment was 3 months. Well, we know what's going to happen in those 3 months. You know, either they're going to end up in the emergency room or they're going to end up in our jail because the behaviors, which are part of their symptoms, if you think someone's following you, which is a really scary thing, there might be some actions that you take that will come to the attention of police. And it isn't that you're trying to hurt someone. It's part of your, you know, delusional thoughts and things like that. I think a lot of what we can do is more upstream in terms of really, again, making sure that people access that care. And I think that would help a lot. There's a lot of diversions that we can do along the way that we just don't have the financial resources to do.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Roy, I want to ask you a question about something that Sheriff Stanek of Hennepin County said a while back. And he said, we've criminalized those who suffer from mental illness. They end up in jail, stay in jail, and recycle through the jail. Do you agree with that? We've criminalized mental illness to high a degree?
One would have to answer that this way, I think, or I will answer it this way. Criminal behavior in itself, in many different situations, could be considered a mental illness. Should a spouse assault their loved ones? Should a person continue to put poison in their bodies, knowing what the consequences will be? I don't necessarily believe there's a conscious decision by legislators or others to create specific statutes that focus on mental illness, but the elements of crimes and the characteristics of crimes often have a connection to mental illness or some crisis that Sue was talking about. I think the real issue that Sheriff Stanek has addressed numerous times, and we certainly are the recipient of many of the folks that come through his facility, that it rises to the crisis stage before it is really dealt with. And Sue has been a fierce advocate for going upstream. But that's not an easy task, because the resources to go upstream, you have to paddle hard and you have to have a pretty expensive canoe to do that. And the governor, through the mental health task force and in our budget request, is requesting millions of dollars to deal with the mental health issues in our facilities. I just hope that translates into the legislature.
When you say upstream, you're talking about, metaphorically, obviously, it's against the current tide, but also getting ahead of treatment of mental illness before it becomes a crisis that requires a law enforcement intervention?
Or criminality that has built on itself. And our folks in prison have an average of 4 prior felonies, 10 total offenses. They have had criminal justice interventions at the county level, and they have been referred to numerous programs, usually. It's not uncommon to have prison inmates have 3 or 4 treatment episodes before they end up in our prisons. So youthful intervention is very important. I was a juvenile probation officer for a long, long time, and those kids present themselves pretty early. And after all the years, I have seen many of those kids end up in our facilities, sad to say.
One of the things you all were nodding at, and that is the idea that while there is a prevalence of mental health issues in the criminal justice system, not all offenses and not all offenders are doing this because of their mental illness. And tell me a little more about that, Commissioner, about separating that and why that's important.
The diagnosis of mental illness in the medical realm is pretty specific, and these folks to the left of me are far more skilled in that diagnosis. And it becomes very difficult when we discuss criminal justice clients. They are every bit as individual as the folks in this room. I'm sure while you might all be called Rotarians, you each have your individual story, your individual histories, your individual occupations. And our prison population and our offender population is just as individual. And a perfect example of that is when we talk about sex offenders who probably have a significant mental illness. As soon as I mention sex offenders in any group, I think folks generally have this impression of the alley assaulter, the scary person in the back room kind of sex offender description. But But the vast majority of sex offenders don't fit that profile, and the vast majority of sex offenders are very easy to supervise. They have complicated problems, but in terms of criminal justice interventions, they're very easy to supervise. The difficulty in putting everybody in the same camp is that we tend to come up with simplistic solutions. And the solutions have to accept that there are people that just commit crimes because they are criminals. They have little regard for law. And there are people that commit crimes because of their mental illness. And the distinction that these folks just talked about is really, really important, that early assessment, that early diagnosis, and that early intervention.
Is it fair to say that more of that would result in fewer cases that come before you in need for correction?
There is research that definitely shows the impact and the return on investment of treatment versus incarceration. Even within our facilities and with our treatment programs, we can demonstrate the return on investment. A person that goes through treatment often has a 20% reduction in future crime commission, and we are relying on that research as we approach the legislature.
And let's talk more about that, because in our reporting we found that the cost of treating someone with mental illness is far less than incarcerating them. Fair to say?
The cost factor, if you just compare it to the daily cost of a prison bed, but the real cost is future crime and future victimization. We know that the work we do prevents future victims, and everything we do in our system is oriented to prevent future crime because we know the impact on those victims. And it is not uncommon to have a $6 payback for every dollar invested in some programs, and in some programs even more. Mm-hmm. So the dollars and cents are easy to calculate, but the human costs and the human are a little more difficult. But it's what motivates all of our corrections work, because we deal with victims all the time, and we know how crime impacts their lives.
Soon, Eduardo, I'd want you to check in as well on this, because it's the time where you're spending a lot of time, especially Sue, at the Capitol, right, during the session. So what's your position on this, what we were just talking about with the commissioner, about investment in mental illness and mental health versus incarceration?
I mean, I can't believe anyone would even, like, think there was an issue around that, because clearly if you intervene early and you help someone, they're not going to go on to be picked up by the police, frankly, by some. I mean, it's often nonviolent acts, and often if people don't have access to treatment or stable housing, they're really rotating through that jail door over and over and over again, and we've never resolved the problem. I think we are a long way away from really fully building our mental health system to meet all the needs. We've made some important steps. I think the biggest thing is that when I look kind of over the history of the mental health movement, we have studied this issue to death. The last thing we need is another study. We know exactly what to do. You know, access to treatment, build our workforce, make sure that we help children, you know, don't suspend kids in K-3. You know, make sure people have access to stable housing, make sure they have a reason to get up in the morning, including employment. I mean, we know exactly what to do. We just need to have the will to do it.
If it's been studied to death, where's the resistance?
I think the resistance is a couple places. I think certainly 20 years ago, there just wasn't as much awareness around it. So I think there's more awareness that this is a policy issue we should be attending to. I think part of it is just finances. We have a mental health parity law that actually doesn't require you cover it, just that if you do it in the same way. That is totally not implemented. We have benefited greatly from Medicaid expansion, and yet that could be gone, you know, in the coming months, which would be horrendous for people with mental illness. You know, it really is just, it has to be the will to do that. And we've had some good years where we've had a big investment in our community mental health system, but I think it also then comes down to the local level. neighbors wanting a crisis center in their neighborhood. No, we don't want that crisis home here. Supportive housing. Oh, no, we don't want that here in our neighborhood. And yet those are your neighbors. One in five people are affected by mental illness. They are your neighbors. We need to develop those community services.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Colon, you're in a large public hospital, and yes, you see this, people who come in who probably have no other place to turn or feel they have no other place to turn, right?
Absolutely. The question is, do they have nowhere to turn when they present, and where do they have to turn to when they leave? And it is so challenging. I couldn't agree more with what Sue has said, that to me the issue is about money and stigma. So a lot of times what I end up seeing as a citizen is that the question becomes, who will spend the money? Because the money ultimately is being spent. It's just whose pocket does it come out of? And if it doesn't come out of services to the people who need them, then it comes out of corrections, then it comes out in terms of human cost. I'd like to address the comment that was made earlier, though. I want to make sure that you understand my bias, perhaps as a physician, is there's a lot of determinants to criminal behavior that many of us don't understand. There's a lot of research outside of my scope. We know there's a lot of genetic and social determinants to criminal behavior that are very important. We know, for example, the role of trauma, which is a social force that we need to be able to manage. So by the time you end up with criminal behavior, I tend to think of criminal behavior separately than mental illness. I don't think of every criminal act as a mental illness. It is guided by a number of psychological events, lack of empathy, lack of regards for boundaries, or issues of aggression, which we need to address socially. We need to address in terms of all of the determinants. And we'd like to focus, where I sit, on mental illnesses that we know we have treatments and interventions that are helpful and can provide relief. So the question for me ultimately becomes, do we remove all the barriers that we have for access to care? We know that even if magically we did, there's still going to be some people who are not going to be able to access or want to access the system. But I strongly believe and hope that that number is quite small once you're able to approach, provide the support and the help that people need. And the help has to come from the beginning, and it has to include the fact that we acknowledge the presence of mental illness. We have a bias that a lot of times perpetrated or enhanced by the media, where it's brought to our attention where a horrible criminal act has been committed that includes a lot of violence by someone with mental illness. And therefore, we begin to equate mental illness with aggression, with severe violence, and with criminal acts. And unfortunately, that represents a small portion of the people that we serve. There's no doubt that there are horrible criminal acts that can happen in the context of a severe mental illness. But that is really just a very small percentage of what we struggle with. And yet, that's the vision that people have. Somebody with mental illness, dangerous. Somebody with mental illness in my neighborhood, crimes. Violence to my children and danger to my safety. Therefore, we don't provide the supports until we all look around us and recognize how prevalent mental illness is among all of us. And when I sit in the room of legislators or regular citizens that begin to talk about their own experience with their loved ones having mental illness, I think that's the kind of discussion that begins to make people realize that this is not them. And we tend to really become very comfortable by saying those people, the mentally ill, a phrase that I know Sue really likes. It is words that we use, but concepts that we use to separate ourselves from it rather than recognizing that that's my neighbor, that's my aunt, that's somebody else, and not everybody with a mental illness is somebody you need to be scared of. By the time you allow mental illness to get out of control, then you have family members who are terrified for their safety and the safety of their loved ones. But that is a function of not being able to, for whatever reason, provide the services that people need, the help that they need early on.
Dr. Colon, are you getting there to the issue, it sounds like to me, of stigma and the stigma around mental illness and how to break that down? And have you seen any strategies to do that seem to work or are working now? Either you or Sue, I would like to hear both.
I think the best strategies that we have are people like Nami and Sue in terms of the work they do in the community. So I will let her talk about it. I think certainly when we have people of importance, and I use that word in quotations, people who are recognized because of their stature, come out and speak to their experience, to what's happened to them. It begins to really make people more at ease with the concept that you can be rich, you can be educated, or you can be the nicest human being in the world that I know, and you have an experience with mental illness, or so does your family. The second part is information, because a lot of us fear what we don't know. So the more I understand the nature of mental illness, what the symptoms are, what the treatments are, and what the outcomes can be, the less scared I am about recognizing that. And then lastly, there's what we've grown up with. Look, and I work among mental health professionals. How oftentimes any of us have needed to access some mental health care, and you acknowledge that all of a sudden you went, I don't know. What are people going to think? What if somebody sees me in the doctor's office? So these are biases that we've grown up with that we need to first of all acknowledge and then tackle. And I think groups like NAMI do an incredible job of not offering support to family members, but getting the word out in ways that people can understand it. So, Sue, can you help me out?
Well, what the research demonstrates is that actually someone sharing their personal story is the most effective way to break down stigma. Because you look at that person and you say, well, that could be my neighbor. That could be my family member. That's not them. It's actually us. And so we really do try to make sure that people are sharing their stories. The other thing just to think about is language. If you think about all the slang words we have for mental illness, crazy, nuts, psycho, there's a ton of them. But what are the slang words for diabetes or heart disease? We don't have them. And if you don't think that's a big deal, ask any author about the importance of words. Ask any civil or human rights movement about the importance of words and language. And I have to say, it is very important that we kind of rid our language, our lexicon, of those words because it makes it harder for someone to come forward. 21-year-old, you know, having their first psychotic episode, doesn't want to tell anyone because he doesn't want anyone to think that he or she is crazy. Mm-hmm. And we need to eliminate that from this area of healthcare.
Are things changing in the media and depictions you mentioned there? Right away, you use the word psycho, and we think of that Alfred Hitchcock movie and the horror of that. And then I'm thinking much more recently, a program which I really loved, Monk, where the hero of the show, even though it was a comedy and often played for laughs, had mental illness and was dealing with his own obsessive compulsive and other things and managed to be the hero of the episode, every episode. Do things like that make a difference in popular culture?
They absolutely do. Unfortunately, television still does a horrible job of portraying people with mental illness as violent, much more violent than other characters and much more violent than in reality. I would say that newspapers have gotten better in terms of the words that they use. They've gotten better in terms of reporting on suicide, doing it correctly so we don't promote contagion. But we still have a long way to go when it comes to the media.
I could comment.
Commissioner Roy, yeah.
I think it's an interesting observation related to that question will be on how the high-profile suicide of Mr. Hernandez will play out. Already there are people reporting about his youth and his trauma in youth, but for folks just to keep track of that related to this question, because it the media could be all over this one for a long time.
And we should say that, and for people who might not be familiar with the case, the NFL player, New England Patriots player, who was found dead in his prison cell. He was serving a sentence for murder and was appealing that. And this has obviously gotten a lot of attention, media attention.
I think it will continue because I think the question about human motivation, what could motivate a person to do those horrendous crimes with a $40 million contract when all of life is shining on you and you commit those kinds of acts. Us humankind are tough to figure out sometimes, and it is related to the stigma question. Beyond the mental health stigma, the criminal conviction stigma, and all the collateral consequences that go along with a felony conviction that interrupt, if a person actually wants to do everything right, that label as a felon can interrupt any positive reintegration into society. And we have made a really concerted effort in the department to employ mental health release planners, because we know that when those folks exit our facilities, they're going to return to the community, they're going to return to the county. And if they aren't connected to those resources that exist, if they aren't following their prescriptions, if they aren't connecting with positive people in terms of housing, their likelihood of failure is greater. So we have designated staff to work closely with those people upon release, because we are not a healing facility. People get stabilized often in prison, but their return back into their home environment can be very destructive, and often they fall right back into the same patterns.
When you say you're not a healing facility, there are mental health services, and there is treatment available, and there are physicians and counselors, right, within the system.
We are realistic. We are the largest chemical dependency treatment organization in the state. We have, on any given day, about 1,000 individuals in chemical dependency treatment, but we recognize that treatment in a facility in itself is not a healing activity. It needs to be a lifelong activity, whereas in the medical community, somebody might come into a hospital and leave healthy. But we are challenged to make the community connections with our community partners, and I'm really pleased to see commissioners here today from the counties and local law enforcement, because the people we release need those community supports that are often provided in the counties.
It needs to continue after
Absolutely.
Release from the system.
Yeah, it's not a although I do have many offenders that, and I often ask the question is during parole hearings, I ask them to reflect back, and these are first-degree murderers. Often I ask them the question, reflect back 30 years when you walked in the door. Had you not walked in the door, where would you be? And almost all of them say that I would be dead. So in terms of continuing life, and I guess we do heal a bit by maintaining life, but we have lots of work to do every day.
But I think you would say, Commissioner Wright, that you also, as a Department of Corrections, need more funding for the prisons to be able to really meet the needs of people who have a mental illness or a substance use disorder that you currently don't have.
Absolutely, and thank you for that, Sue.
We add there.
Yeah, right.
For every 100 treatment beds, it's $1.3 million. It's not cheap to provide treatment. You need extra security staff. You need treatment staff. The legislature a few years ago did give us some resources to increase both sex offender and chemical dependency treatment. But we have a major request in this year, and I'm going to knock on wood and keep my fingers crossed and that we get additional funding.
And I'll keep nudging you. Yeah.
And I'll support you in every way I can. So.
I will tell you that I live, from a bias standpoint, I live in Hennepin County, and we have an incredible working relationship with Hennepin County in terms of what we try to do with people who are in the jail system. And we could talk for a long time about how it could be a lot better. And yet, when I think of outlying counties that don't have the resources, it makes me realize that in many ways we are rich, but we need so much more. Early on for us, the implication of providing services in the jail meant that we provided access to medications where people needed medications. Well, as a psychiatrist, I'm a firm believer of medications, but I also understand very clearly that that's a small part of a very large puzzle, and we need to provide more services than that. And yet when people are in the correction system, they're not in the hospital. They're not in the mental health system. They're in a facility where we try and provide some services. We're now working on providing a number of other activities for people who come and go because the population in the jail gets released before they have plans, before they get stabilized on meds. There's a lot of complications, but this is really only a very small part of a very large puzzle. And as a citizen, frankly, I do not mind my tax money going to provide services to anybody in those systems, because I like to tell my patients, there but for the grace of God. There is nothing more tragic for me than to hear somebody who comes to my clinic argue that they actually feel more comfortable when they return to jail. To me, that means we really fail them as a system somehow.
How often would you say that, get that response?
I would say that that's probably a very small amount, but mm-hmm. it's strong enough to stay with me.
Yeah.
As well as when I see people in the hospital, I do consultations with the rest of the hospital who've just been released from jail. They had the best intention, not the jail, from the correctional system. best intention of maintaining their sobriety, and within days of being in the community, not having anywhere to go, finding their old buddies they're using again because it's the easy way out. It's what they know how to do, and otherwise it's too challenging. So we can always blame the person who's going through that, but I also ask myself, what do we do? If I send you out the door and I put you through treatment and I have you live two blocks from the crack house where you used to get your drugs, how is it that I expect you to maintain sobriety when you don't have the right support? And so this is not cheap. It's expensive. And as a society, at some point, we have choices to make in terms of how our money is being spent. Easy for me to say from where I sit, but I have no doubt that we need to invest more money in providing this care in the correction system.
Tom, you have failed to mention the gender issue, and I think it's really, really important to talk. We have one female prison in the state of Minnesota in Shakopee, and Dr. Cologne mentioned trauma, and the women in our Shakopee facility have experienced incredible trauma in their lives in terms of being victims, subjects of abuse from a very early age, significant chemical dependencies, and their return. And you asked how frequently people comment on their fear of going back. It's pretty common with our female population to be very fearful about the life they're going to return to, whether that's an abusive, a neglectful family, the responsibilities of motherhood. This life is daunting. It's daunting for everyone in this room, but for our female folks that exiting prison, life can be very, very daunting.
And if you're going to talk about trauma, I think the notion even is if you don't come from a life of trauma, which most of our patients do, if you have a mental illness and you're in a system that's constrained where there may be criminal behavior, I think the likelihood of you suffering extra to be traumatized again also begins to escalate. And this is a big challenge, I think, for correctional facilities, is the protection of inmates, the protection of people who may be victimized. When you think about mental illness in general, if you happen to be in high school and grade school and you're beginning to show signs and symptoms of mental illness, the trauma that you can get exposed to because of the stigma we talked about before, being bullied, being abused, or being traumatized in one of many other ways, then it becomes something that just gets perpetrated throughout the rest of the life cycle and does not end up in a good place.
I want to leave some time for some other issues, but Commissioner Roy, I just want to touch on briefly an issue that's gotten a lot of attention in the media nationally and here in Minnesota, and that is administrative solitary confinement and its impact on the mental health of the person undergoing that. Tell us, what's Minnesota's policy on it? When is it used, and how does that compare to other states, and is Minnesota among the states that we hear are reexamining the way it's used and looking at this again?
We are clearly reexamining our policies and procedures, and we have been working on this for a couple of years pretty significantly. Let me step back a bit. The Foundation for Corrections generally in prison, there are basically four reasons that we use incarceration. For rehabilitation, that we've talked about a little bit, for deterrence, so that people say, I shouldn't do that activity because I could get in trouble. Incapacitation, when we lock people up, they can't commit crimes. And just deserts. If you do something wrong, you're going to experience a desert of some kind. And as we raise children and families, some of those concepts we have used as well. But in terms of restrictive housing or segregation, we continue to have people that act out criminally and in violation of the rules, that some of those concepts continue. We need deserts. We need consequences when somebody stabs their cellmate or throws body substances on or assaults corrections officers. We have to maintain a safe environment for those other folks in prison who just want to do their time and get out. And we have to maintain a safe workplace for our thousands of corrections officers and other prison staff. None of you in this room would tolerate being assaulted at work. You would have a high expectation that there is a consequence for that. Unfortunately, we are very limited in the prison environment about what we can do. We have discipline processes that end up often in segregation terms. These people are isolated until they have de-escalated. We're very pleased that nationally there is an effort going on, because clearly there are tens of thousands of people in segregation housing right now. In Minnesota, and you asked the question how we compare to other states,
right,
we have five people that have been in segregated housing over 2 years right now. In this country right now, there are about 13,000 in other prisons in other states. So we have a relatively small number of long-term people, but we are in the middle of the mix in terms of the lesser segregated housing. Our average stay right now is 22.9 days. I'm sorry, the last report shows 16 days. So we have made a reduction even from January of 16 to March of 17 by 5 days. Segregation is not an ideal, and it is clearly not ideal for somebody that has mental illness. And to that end, we have a specialized mental health unit at our Oak Park Height facility. So if somebody is demonstrating really aberrant behavior, assaultive behavior, self-mutilation, they're going to end up in the mental health unit. Unfortunately, sometimes those same activities end up in assaults on other inmates or other staff, and they tend to escalate and build on themselves. And the intervention is very, very difficult with some very, very difficult people. It's too early in the day to talk specifically about cases. I could tell you some horror stories that would affect you deeply. They affect our staff deeply. It's a population that there are no alternatives for. Mm-hmm. And we are the end of ends. And it's very sad, and Sue has done some great work for a new statute that is going to require us to report out, which is great. It's going to require some conditions of confinement that will improve what we're doing, and you should be applauded for your work, and thank you. But we have a ways to go, but we're getting there.
And I think if I can just add, and I appreciate your voice.
You've been public about opposing.
Very public, yes.
About opposing solitary confinement for especially people suffering from mental health issues.
And we do realize that it sometimes has to be used what we wanted. And, you know, I think we have a good working relationship with Commissioner Roy. But, you know, you won't be there forever. And so what we wanted to make sure is there was something in statute to say, first of all, you can use this. Second of all, here's the conditions of those cells. Wanting to make sure that people don't return to our community before going to the general population community. I think you can understand if you're in a cell and you've been there for a long time, going back to the general community would be really hard. And then just
you mean
having,
directly from
correct,
solitary?
From solitary to the community. First, you should make a stop if you can in the general population. But I think the reporting issue is really important. So there's transparency about what's happening. Everyone knows what's going on. We, you know, certainly support your efforts to add more staff and things like that, so maybe people don't go there. But we just think that transparency has to be there, because you aren't going to be there forever.
I want to... from each of you, a strategy or a practice that is working, that maybe people don't quite understand is working, or aspirationally a strategy or practice that you'd like to see work, that you know works, but that we can't get to yet. I'll start with you, Commissioner Roy.
Transitional housing, and Sue mentioned the importance of that, and the doctor did too, in terms of people exiting either a hospital or a mental health facility of some kind. Often the homeless or very temporary housing is the only thing available. And many of these folks really need supportive services, especially in the first month or two after release. And typically people would call them halfway houses or terms of chemical dependency. But staff are on board. It's an environment that is usually chemically free. Mm-hmm. And
is it housing in a neighborhood? Is it restrictive in any way? Or once people have served their time, they're
Yes, free.
Okay.
The ideal is to have those located near services, near jobs, near transportation, so that people can take advantage of those things and assume a normal life. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, as Sue referenced, the placement of those supportive housing units is becoming very problematic. Right now in the state of Minnesota, there are 60 communities that have done municipal housing restrictions on sex offenders, and it eliminates their entire communities even for their own residents returning. And the notion is that those restrictions are creating a safer environment, and all of the research and all of the experts say that when you destabilize housing, you impact negatively public safety. People go underground, they leave the jurisdiction, they leave their supervision. As difficult as it is to welcome those people back, it's something we have to do, because if they aren't coming back to your neighborhood, they're going back to somebody else's. And why would we think less of somebody else's neighborhood? These are our citizens. They have done terrible things often, but they have served their time. And the best strategy for public safety is to support them upon their return. Make every effort we can to get them the right treatment, to get stable housing, and in the end, we all benefit by that.
Sue Abderholden, for you, a strategy or practice that works or could or should work?
So I'm not going to talk about the mental health system because you don't have enough time. So I'm just going to focus on, you know, kind of that intersection.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, first having mobile mental health crisis teams so that we have a healthcare response and not a police response. But right now we have 40 phone numbers in the state of Minnesota. So I think also 911 operators, which are now doing this in St. Paul, doing that, you know, warm handoff to the crisis team. If someone gets, you know, if the police do come out, police training we know is very effective, and there is money right now in the House bill for training on mental illness. Also making sure that people get treatment in the jail, where that's really important. We have sometimes very limited formularies, and the worst place to change someone's antipsychotic is in the jail. And then making sure that we really have discharge planning. People lose their Medicaid when they go into jail. So they need to leave the jail with medication and getting reconnected to their insurance so they can go on with their treatment once they return to the community.
Okay.
So, and these strategies have been around for decades.
Are they being applied as often as they need to be?
Absolutely not.
The crisis team. Yeah.
The crisis teams are actually mental health professionals and practitioners who can actually go out to where someone is. They can de-escalate the situation. They can connect people to resources. They can provide stabilization for 10 days.
And they're mental health professionals?
Or practitioners who are being supervised. Yep.
Right.
And it can be extremely effective in terms of really resolving that situation right then and there.
Often with police practitioners as well, there are models where police agencies have teamed with those professionals. And there's also another very significant training that's going on, crisis intervention training. We have about 300 of our staff that are trained on how to deal with our folks who are in mental health crisis within our facilities so that we can de-escalate them so they don't end up in segregation. And we are teaming with many of our police departments in that training. And there is also a pretty substantial budgetary request to enhance CIT training for law enforcement.
CIT, crisis intervention training.
Yeah. And it's Minnesota is clearly leading the nation in that training. And Sue's organization has been phenomenal in facilitating that training.
Dr. Colon, for you, a solution or practice that works?
I get to speak last, so I can tell you that I don't have a lot that's brilliant to add, except that will underscore the crisis intervention training is crucial, not just for police officers to be able to assist our crisis personnel when they need help to manage and to bring people to the hospital, but also to recognize and acknowledge the presence of mental illness when they get called to a scene where a patient with mental illness who has not been identified by a mental health professional is in crisis, so that the intervention is safe both for the officer but also for the patient as well as for family members who at that point are a huge part of the crisis, and we tend to forget about them once the person who is ill gets taken out of the scene or transported. I am absolutely convinced that we need to bolster our screening in the jail system and the correctional system so that anybody who walks in the jail, we're trying to do that in Hennepin County, is assessed by or evaluated at the entrance, at the entry point, by someone with training in mental illness so that they can recognize who is going to need the ongoing intervention and the help. And, of course, I've talked quite a bit about our wish to provide more ongoing health care, and we have somebody in our county jail 7 days a week trying to assist with the screening and certainly during the week to provide with the care. Lastly, I mentioned and I will underscore the importance of tying up loose ends when people leave, particularly in the jail system. Nobody knows when somebody's going to be there next week for me to see them because they may go to the court and get released. They may post bail, and it's a very difficult and challenging task. But we need to make sure that where possible, people get connected so their insurance gets renewed so that they have access to transitional medications and they just don't end up in the community looking for a place to see them a month from now, and in the meantime, out of medications, which they were willing to take. So we need to connect these people who are leaving, who we have identified, into the services and the things that they need. And lastly, I think I can't say enough about the importance for safe, supportive housing, because when people return to the community, if they cannot be in a safe, supportive environment, everything else falls apart.
Dr. Eduardo Colon, Chief of Psychiatry at Hennepin County Medical Center. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Minnesota, or NAMI Minnesota. And Tom Roy, Commissioner of Minnesota's Department of Corrections. I can't thank you enough for your insight into all of this, taking on all of our questions. A very big topic. You've given us a lot to think about and a lot of understanding. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Looking for a new podcast? I'm Tracy Mumford, a producer for NPR News. I'm part of the team working on 74 Seconds. It's a new podcast that looks at the shooting death of Philando Castile by Officer Geronimo Yanez. It happened last summer in Falcon Heights, Minnesota. Yanez is now facing charges in Castile's death. 74 Seconds looks at what happened that night and what happens now when a police officer goes on trial. Reporters John Collins and Reham Fashir will walk you through this case as it unfolds. It's a story about race, policing, and justice in America. Subscribe to 74 Seconds wherever you get your podcasts.